explain the ordinary understanding of autonomous control, which the ego-death experience proves to be illusory. I've talked a little about the word illusory and the problems with that word. It's just too blunt. It's a first-order approximation. And more for a second-order explanation, we need to talk in terms of distortions and precision of mental models, rather than just saying something exists or doesn't exist, or saying that the self is an illusion or isn't an illusion. It's really more a matter of more precise systems description being needed. Explain the ordinary understanding of autonomous control, which proves to be in some sense illusory. The main question here is, prior to the mystic state experience, how do we usually, what does it mean to say that we experience ourselves as autonomous controllers? Autonomous control and autonomous controllers, what's that all about prior to the mystic altered state? How is that transformed in the mystic altered state? Autonomous control. This is a William James question, really. It's a question about subjective psychological experiencing and the shape of our experience in the stream of mental constructs of our experience. What's it like, Thomas Nagel asks, what's it like to be a bat? He looks at the shape of that question. What's it like to be a bat, meaning the flying mouse? What's it like to be an egoic autonomous controller or control agent? What's that like? We as people, as persons, experience ourselves, first of all, as autonomous controllers. That means that our experience and our stream of experience during the day is so routinely shaped as with elements of autonomous controller concerns that we don't even notice that fact. We don't really think about it. But our lives are a sequence of decisions. We're constantly making decisions and identifying ourselves as I am the decider. I am the one who makes the decisions. I am a decision maker entity, and I, as a person, am busy all the time making decisions. Our sense of ordinary, mundane, day-to-day identity and our experience, just in general, our experience of life is the experience of continuously, constantly making decisions. Making decisions is like breathing air for us. We don't even notice it because we're always continuously and constantly focusing on making decisions. The ego, the person, and the sense of being a person is the sense of making decisions, the power to make decisions, to execute the process of making decisions, and then to act on those decisions, decisions and actions. Our stream of consciousness, if you stand back and look at the shape of it, it's shaped in the form of being a decision maker and executor of actions based on those decisions that's moving through time and space and is separated from other decision makers and objects in the world. Especially for the purposes of studying the ego-death experience and what that's all about and what religious revelation is all about and enlightenment. For those purposes, certainly, the first way to conceive the shape of the mental constructs within someone's stream of consciousness throughout their life is to look at that stream of consciousness and look at those mental constructs in that stream of consciousness, look for factors or constructs that have to do with being a distinct controller and decision maker, a locus of decision making, and including the ability to act on those decisions, moving through time and space, separated from other controllers and decision executors who are also moving through time and space, and distinct from objects in the physical realm. For the purposes of studying religious revelation and ego death and enlightenment, that is the way that we need to think about the ego. Non-duality says that that's not actually the case. It says that we're not really separate selves, but that it just seems that we are. I talk about it in a little different way. I say that the stream of consciousness certainly exists, and the stream of mental constructs exists. There's really no question about that. And it's shaped in the form of a separate person. It's shaped as though there's a separate person who travels through time and space, making decisions and doing actions upon those decisions. It's that feeling that when it goes away, we experience as death. There's also this sense of, there's our body sense, our mental body image, which we have control over our body, and we experience the mind. The stream of consciousness includes control over the body and mental constructs used to support that control. There's the body and body spatial, the spatial extent of the body. In the mystic altered state, that sense merges in with the whole of everything, so that one feels that one's body is physically merged into the physical realm, as though one is fastened to a cross or trapped within a coffin or fastened to a tree or tied to the magic bench in Hades for eternity with snakes. Those are all metaphors for this feeling of spatial merging. There's also the feeling of time merging. That's the most important thing to say about our deeply accustomed, almost invisibly accustomed sense of autonomous control and being an autonomous controller. to introduce yourself and say your name is to say, hi, I'm Joe. I'm introducing myself to other autonomous controllers, and I'm an autonomous controller, and I'm moving through time and space just like other autonomous controllers are, and I'm not an object, I'm separate from it. All of that usual feeling, which is so familiar that we don't experience it, we're oblivious to it, because since we're constantly experiencing ourselves as autonomous controllers and decision agents, we don't consciously think of ourselves as that way very much, because we're always doing that. That's so much what we are and what we consist of and what the sense of self-personal identity consists of. The body spread in space, but isolated from it, and spread through time, but isolated from time, and isolated from other agents. That is the self-sense which dies upon ego death. Is this autonomous control an illusion? Well, it involves illusory aspects. Religious revelation and mystic enlightenment is all about saying, in some sense, X, but in some sense, Y. The whole challenge is, what are those senses? In what sense is the autonomous control that one wields an illusion? And in what sense is autonomous control not an illusion? Does control exist in space-time? Is there control? Does the world contain any control? Well, certainly. Does the world contain any people? Certainly. Any individuals? Certainly. The world involves and contains individuals. Are individuals real? Yes. Is the ego real? Yes, in a sense. No, in a sense. And what are those senses? It's all about defining our senses. We know nothing about whether the ego exists or not until we define our terms, and especially until we define in what sense does the ego exist, and in what sense we've got to identify in what specific sense the ego does not exist. Normally, we experience ourselves as, or the mind experiences itself, the mind experiences the self, the personal self, as an autonomous controller which is responsible for creating its own future. Now, do we create our own future? In a sense, yes. In a sense, no. What are those senses? In what sense does the personal autonomous controller create its future? And in what sense is the personal autonomous controller unable to exert any change on its own future and unable to create its future? In the dissociative state, we play with the ideas of having control, losing control. But you might say, well, when I lost control, I realized that I didn't lose control because I never had control in the first place. So the whole issue of what it means to possess control becomes problematized in the altered mystic dissociative state. It's not just that we lose control in the dissociative state, it's the whole feeling and concept and experience and assumptions about having control in the first place are all problematized. The whole notion of having control or wielding control is thoroughly problematized. Not that it's simply thrown out as an illusion, as though I thought there was control, or I thought I wielded control, and now I realize that I don't wield control. Well, that's false. I mean, you do wield control. The issue is all about in what sense we start off life in some sense with some particular sense of some particular understanding or misunderstanding about this nature of our control-wielding position. After enlightenment, we have a different, revised, transformed idea about in what sense do we wield control over our future thoughts and our future control thoughts and our future control-related actions. Really, the challenge here is to explain how is our understanding about personal autonomous control revised from so that we start off with one idea about, and they're both positive, that before enlightenment, we think of ourselves as autonomous controllers. After enlightenment, we think of ourselves as autonomous controllers. But there is a difference in those two different understandings. After enlightenment, we re-understand ourselves now in a different way as being autonomous controllers. Some Zen kind of clever sayings fit into this kind of pattern of talking, that before I was enlightened, I went to the store. After I was enlightened, I went to the store, but it was entirely different. Before enlightenment, I was an autonomous controller. After enlightenment, I was also an autonomous controller. Before enlightenment, I was a control agent. And after enlightenment, I was a control agent, but now transformed. So what does this transformation of, it's really much more about a transformation of autonomous control, or a transformation of our understanding, our mental model about autonomous control. That's why I do mention the word illusion and illusory to help explain things, but ultimately I talk more in terms, it's more useful, powerful, and practical to talk in terms of revising our understanding of ourselves as autonomous controllers rather than simply doing what most writers on Eastern religion do and say the self is an illusion and they kind of leave it at that. And that won't do. That's not an explanation to say that non-duality is the case and the separate self is an illusion. We still, after saying those things, it remains the real task, the real work remains of explaining in what exact way is our mental model of autonomous control transformed during the mystic dissociative altered state. In religious revelation, the real question isn't, in part of it could be considered the question of in what sense is personal control an illusion. But the more central question really is the more broad, general question of in what way is the mental model of personal control agency transformed in the dissociative state? That really ultimately is the real productive question there. And towards answering that question, it's sometimes useful to bring in the concept of illusion. But by itself, the concept of illusion is not structured in such a way as to be a very useful, practical concept. Illusion is more a matter of distortion, that we start off with a distorted, somewhat irrational and problematic, but secretly, covertly problematic. Our original initial mental model about our personal control agency it's secretly problematic. We're not aware that it's problematic, but in the dissociative state, the problematic aspects of our initial self-conception as autonomous agents, it's revealed to be problematic. Then we have to solve that problem, thus producing a transformed mental model of our personal agency. Illusion is an important part of this discussion, but should not be conceived of as the whole central focus of this discussion. The central focus is more of how is autonomous controllership reconceived, not just how is it originally an illusion, and then you cast off that illusion. Explain the ordinary understanding of autonomous control, that means a bunch of things, which the ego-death experience proves to be illusory. The question's predominant focus is on autonomous control, and the secondary emphasis also is on the ego-death experience showing illusory aspects of that autonomous control. Autonomous. We have semantics issues here. The mind has all these connotations about autonomous and about controllership, and those networks, those semantic networks of connotations undergo a transformation in the ego-death experience. Autonomous, controllership, and illusion. In some sense, you can say that prior to initiation, we have a certain semantic net around the notion of autonomous, and we have a semantic net around the notion of control or controllership, and those semantic nets include aspects that can be called illusory. Before enlightenment, autonomous controllership involves the naive, careless, casual, automatic, natural assumption that we, as control agents, we create our future, and the future is wide open, doesn't exist, and that it is our responsibility. We hold the reins of responsibility for making our future happen. That we do this so that, therefore, we're autonomous in that sense. We're responsible. It's up to us. Our future is up to us, and it's not defined yet. And defining our future, creating our future, is left up to us. That is some description of the original initial mental model about our autonomous control. After enlightenment, you could also say that we are autonomous control agents, but the mental model there and the semantic networks are revised after enlightenment so that we reconceive what we mean by this notion or this assumption of autonomy and the notion or assumption of control or controllership. After enlightenment, you can work the problem from two directions and then converge them. Discuss what it's like to be discuss the mental model prior to initiation regarding the notions of autonomy and controllership. Then from the other side of the fence, come in from that trajectory or vector and discuss how, after a series of initiations, how does the mind then conceive our so-called autonomy and our so-called controllership? Then contrast those two different semantic networks against each other. Before enlightenment, I thought of myself as an autonomous controller. After enlightenment, I thought of myself as an autonomous controller, but in a different way, and in a more constrained, restricted, limited sense. That is a characteristic difference or distinction between how autonomous control is initially conceived versus how it's conceived after salvific regeneration, is that originally autonomous control is conceived of as more of a monolithic, single, simple autonomy, more of an absolute, unqualified autonomy, and unqualified, isolated, simple, simply isolated, monolithic personal control and controllership and control power. I simply wield control, I create my own future, and that's that. That's the initial sense and mental model of being an autonomous personal controller. The main revision to the mental model that goes on during the series of mystic state initiations is to qualify that. Basically, a good analogy here is that Newton starts off with his system of physics and mathematical physics, and Einstein comes along and says, well, that's pretty good so far as it goes, but we actually need to qualify that and restrict that and add qualifiers. Well, so it goes in. So you might say that Newton's system of physics is an illusion, and Einstein comes along and points out that it's an illusion, and comes along and points out the truth, and points out the reality of space-time, whereas Newton suffered from a delusion and had an illusory nature of space-time, illusory mental model of space-time. You see, that wouldn't be very useful a way of framing it, and it's better to say that Newton's system of space-time physics was modified by Einstein's approach. So would I say that you could say that the egoic model, mental model of autonomous control, and that experience of autonomous control is not so much thrown out as a wholesale illusion. Now, it feels like it can, like a whole death experience. It certainly is experienced in the throes of the midst of the peak window of the mystic altered dissociative state. It certainly definitely does feel like a death. Like, I'm pretty sure I'm dead now, someone says. You can actually live through and undergo the feeling and the experience of being dead. The experience of, I feel and I'm dead now. I can tell I'm dead. I feel dead. I'm dead. I've died. You can say that. You can experience that feeling. As an autonomous controller, I feel that I've died. I'm detecting now and perceiving that I've died now as an autonomous controller. That's the kind of experience that religious experience presents the theorist with, this challenge of explaining this experience. How could one possibly say that in a mentally coherent way? How could someone say, what could they possibly mean when saying, when uttering the presumably legitimate statement that I'm detecting that I'm dead as an autonomous controller? I'm now dead. What could that statement possibly mean? How do we make sense out of that riddle and solve that riddle of meaning? Rather than really talking about in terms of illusion, it's more a matter of qualifying that original sense is gone. So there's almost three phases here, or three, there's sort of a pair and an intermediate experience. There's a pair of understandings and an immediate experience, intermediate experience. First, there's the mental model, the egoic mental model. In the end, there's the transcendent mental model of personal autonomy. In between, there's the mystic state experience of being dead, or experience of having died as an autonomous control agent. Then that's why there's this rebirth metaphor. Rebirth, but into a different transformed mental model of a transformed mental model of autonomous control. The concept, notion, and term of illusory is in fact often used. People often say, but see that from that point of view, the term illusion serves more, instead, rather than functioning as an explanation, it's really serving as more of the thing, the riddle to be explained. Instead of saying autonomous control is revealed, something's revealed about, and what's revealed is that it's an illusion. That's my explanation. Well, no, that's not really the problem at hand. The problem at hand is more like, people explain the disappearance, the transformation of the feeling of autonomous control in terms of illusion. What do they mean? That's really the problem at hand, is what does the term illusion here mean when applied to the concept of autonomous control? To say that autonomous control, personal autonomous control, is an illusion means what? What does that mean to say that it has illusory aspects? Normally, to say that autonomous control originally has illusory aspects, or that autonomous control is an illusion which is revealed to be such, what does that mean to say that autonomous control is an illusion? How do we make sense out of that in a simple, straightforward, comprehensible way? I explained it pretty well a few minutes ago in my original stab, or earlier stab at this question, that if you contrast the pre and post Enlightenment mental models of autonomous control, one can say afterwards that it was an illusion that my control was simply autonomous. Now I think of myself maybe as autonomous, one could say, but it's a qualified autonomy. It's not a simple, full, complete, monolithic autonomy now. It's a more of a married autonomy in terms of the Buddhist system. The individual, or the apparently separate self, after enlightenment, is recognized by the mind to be a participant portion of the ground of being, which is why, really, Buddhist non-duality really is totally equivalent to the sacred marriage, especially if we bracket aside the whole issue of transcending determinism and the divine as being ultra-transcendent, transcending fatedness. Now, concepts like Isis and her control over the world really don't necessarily involve a radical transcendence of determinism or transcending Heimarmony. I consider transcending Heimarmony to be a later phase of religion in antiquity, ancient religion. The idea of transcending Heimarmony was largely brought about due to sort of escalating competition between religious systems. Certainly a lot of religious systems in antiquity had a death experience, and that could be completely explained simply by a two-level system where you move from naive free will to belief in determinism and Heimarmony without need. That death experience doesn't necessarily need to be resolved through a jump to determinism transcendence at all. The determinism transcendence is more of a fleeting, optional element in the history of Western religion. I would not say that all Western religion leads up to transcending determinism. More, I would say much more, that all Western religion is centered around the experience of fatedness. All Western religion is centered around the experience of fatedness and the related nexus of experiences. And that's reflected in religious mythology and in acid rock lyrics. And it's found plentifully in Buddhist philosophy, Eastern religion, world religion in general. Fatedness and the loss of the sense of control, which inherently means the loss of sense of being a definer of one's future thoughts. How the term illusion is actually used. This is an explanation of how the term illusion is used. When we say autonomous control is illusory in egoic mental world model, we're saying that it's inaccurate, both that it's inaccurate, that actually our autonomy needs to be, our idea of autonomy needs to actually be qualified, and so in that sense there's illusion that has to be corrected, and also that during the intense dissociative mystic state there's the quite vivid, plain feeling and experience of the unreality of one's sense, the sort of synthetic, artificial, mentally constructed impression, an artificial, mentally constructed impression of ourselves being an autonomous controller. So much of this statement that autonomous control is an illusion really is a statement about our the way that the mind works in terms of mental constructs. That I thought that I directly, simply experienced myself as an autonomous controller, but now I realize that this feeling of autonomous control was just a mental construct generated, not that it was just only a mental construct, but that I now know that I experience my autonomy of control. I experience it through the medium, by the mind using the medium of artificial synthetic mental constructs. So in that sense, in a couple senses, it's an illusion. And I would associate the experience of this illusion, the experience of, hey, autonomous control is an illusion, that experience really is pretty much equivalent with saying that, hey, I discovered and experience my autonomy of control in the form of and through the medium of artificial synthetic mental constructs that my mind generates, like a cartoon. I now know that my actual sense of being a personal controller, or how I monitor and experience and perceive the means by which I perceive my autonomy of control, is mental constructs, and mental constructs are like illusions in that they are indirect representations or tokens that stand in for the things that they actually are. So there's a couple distinct senses in which our ordinary mental model of autonomous control is an illusion. One reason it's in an illusion is that it exists, that it's known to the mind through the medium of mental constructs, which represent representational mental constructs. And another sense in which our initial mental model of autonomous control is an illusion is that it's a distorted view, because it's an unqualified, simple, monolithic feeling of autonomy and independence and having control over our future thoughts. Now, actually, from the point of view of time as a space-like dimension, we do not have the kind of control over our future thoughts that enables us to make them one thing or another. There's only a single actually possible future thought, and it's already exists. So in that sense, autonomy of control is an illusion. What does the transcendence of no free will mean and involve? Not all Western religion includes the idea of transcending no free will. In the competition between variants of religion, it was pretty inevitable, and it's inevitable. And Christianity was highly competitive this way. Anything that other religions did, Christianity made sure to try to one-up or at least match them. So if other religions talked about realizing enlightenment, that things are controlled by high harmony or determinism or fatedness, well, Christianity would do its best to one-up those using what the Gnostics had formulated of one-upping the cosmic ruler and going to instead worship the transcosmic super-hyper ruler in the mysterious ultra-transcendent heavens. I'm definitely not saying that all forms of religion are focused ultimately on transcending free will. I am saying that you cannot say at all that you understand Western religion until you're versed in ideas about transcending no free will. Insofar as transcending no free will is included in a theme in many versions of Western religion and plenty of versions of Eastern religion as well, what does that idea of transcending no free will mean, both in the ego-death theory and in the religions in the history of Western religion? Well, first of all, it means affirming no free will, never denying that no free will is the case. There's every reason to talk about the Gnostics here. The Gnostics provide the canonical example, an early example of transcending no free will. Now, that theme is found a lot in Catholic religious mythology as well, and in the New Testament Christianity, which was largely derived from Gnosticism. So a great first case study is Gnostics, because that directly explains a lot of New Testament Christianity. The transcendence of no free will in Gnosticism and in early Gnostic Christianity. The transcendence of no free will, what does that mean? Well, it means, in ancient terms, transcending cosmic hymarmony, passing through the sphere of the fixed stars, and passing out of the realm to go back to pre-Christian Gnostic views means leaving the realm of cosmic determinism or cosmic heimarmony ruled by the Jewish creator God, and leaving that behind. And it does not mean denying it's the case. It means affirming that the cosmos is in fact ruled by the evil demiurge and heimarmony and fatedness, but then moving beyond that, outside of that, to leave the cosmos behind. And of course, as the bishops complained, that would mean leaving political power behind as well, but, or it would imply, at least in some metaphorical sense, at least leaving political power behind, and then ascending outside the cosmic, leaving the cosmos and ascending into the heavens, which are outside the cosmos. They're outside certainly the heimarmony ruled main area of the cosmos, and entering instead the transcosmic, extracosmic, outside the cosmos, higher heavens, which is ruled not by the creator, Jewish creator God, who is the ruler and archon, the lead archon and demiurge, but then entering into the sphere of the, beyond the sphere of the fixed stars, the heavens above that sphere, entering into the realm, the separate, distinct realm of the separate God, the alien, hidden, unknown God, who is ultra-transcendent, who only and strictly and exclusively exists in a area that's outside the heimarmony, fatedness-ruled cosmos. That was the Gnostic system, much of which got pulled into New Testament Christianity. Now the question here is, so that's kind of how transcendence of no free will is metaphorized. But now, in non-metaphorical terms, or less metaphorical terms, and non-mythological terms, what does transcendence of heimarmony mean? It's easier to approach this question since the term free will is contaminated by modern era, ordinary state-based reductionist understandings. It's the most practical and easy and efficacious approach to answering, to explaining what does it mean, transcendence of no free will. The most efficacious approach is to explain first, what does it mean to transcend heimarmony or cosmic fatedness? And really, whenever we ask about the role of free will in the ego death theory, it's really more useful to ask about the role of cosmic fatedness, or just in general, fatedness. So you might say, instead of this question, you might ask, what does the transcendence of fatedness mean and involve? What does it mean and what does it involve to transcend fatedness? Now, fatedness is the belief, feeling, sensation, experience of one's future thoughts, including one's near future control-related thoughts, being unalterable, given to oneself, in some sense outside of one's power. One is powerless to define or deviate from or control one's own near future control thoughts. That's fatedness. They already exist, they're arriving inevitably, there's nothing you can do about it to change them. All you can do is sit and go through the work, go through the motions of working out your decisions, but those decision paths and working outs are already all predefined and already exist, in fact. That's fatedness. Now, another term is that's cosmic heimarmony. Now, the question here is, what would it mean? What does it mean? What could it mean to transcend, and sort of how can you rationally, simply, and comprehensibly make sense out of the idea of transcending fatedness? Now, why would you want to transcend fatedness? Is fatedness a problem? Is fatedness experienced as a problem, as an urgent crisis, as a panic attack, as a terrible death, as a psychotic mayhem? Fatedness, yes, is often and even typically experienced as those things. One can recoil against it, especially in a culture that's not used to dealing with these things. we recoil against fatedness when we perceive it. We are electrically shocked and zapped as by lightning, like Semele by Zeus. When we perceive fatedness, and that is metaphorically to say that when we see the snake, or when we see our own snake-shaped future and our powerlessness, our the sort of powerlessness over it that we have, that is often experienced as a problem, as a crisis, as a panic attack, as a complete freakout, as a maximum freakout. And especially in those cases, then one strategy, technique, a classic strategy, classic technique for the solution to this panic, alarming problem of fatedness and our powerlessness over our own near future control thoughts, a solution is to jump out of the system in some Hofstadterian, Douglas Hofstadter type of transcendent leap, as if we are pulled out of the system by something completely outside the system. The mind, in various techniques, reconciles itself with fatedness and with non-existent, the lack of personal, powerful existence. Upon restabilizing, upon reconciling this way, there's various metaphors and ways of understanding this restabilization. One way is to understand this restabilization as transcending fatedness. What does the transcendence of no free will mean and involve? So we have to discuss Gnosticism and its role, and why the church, ruling class church fathers, had to carefully integrate that in a politically useful way. Transcendence of no free will, is it found in Eastern? Is it found in Western? What does the transcendence of no free will? I'm thinking that what does the concept of transcendence of no free will mean and involve? It has to do with establishing your relationship. How do you trust if the universe is not personal or is impersonal, then, and you're trusting it with your control of your controllership. Here I am, helplessly, with no power of my own, completely subjected to the mother of all machines. Can she be trusted? On what basis can one trust the ground of being? And there you have the problem of wrathful and compassionate deities. How can we think of the ground of being as a deity, like as in a compassionate deity? Is the ground of being a compassionate deity? Is the non-dual ground of being, who holds your near future thoughts and control actions in its hands, is this ground of being that you so glorify, that we're glorifying, is this ground of being, can it be trusted? If we glorify the ground of being, then from the person's local locus of control, the issue of trust arises for that, from the point of view. Non-duality raises the question of points of view and how things are arranged, and how the local point of view establishes the divine sacred marriage trust relationship with the other person. You might say, well, the subjective sense of controllership and control, wielding control power, is an illusion. Well, it may be an illusion. You can label it an illusion, but it's actually how things are. We're more, the issue is how are things structured? And there's a structure of dependency of that local portion of the control system on the whole of the control system. And how is that a functional relationship? Really, religion is about the relationship of the whole. Having an upbeat tone, while I condemn and criticize everything that's all a lie and a reality tunnel, a matrix, the whole modern era misunderstanding is designed to be an obscuring mask of over the a way of God escaping from knowledge of himself. It's designed to be a confusion. It's a big misleading scam. We've been misled. Explain the concept of block universe determinism and time as a space-like dimension. Control is spread across through. Does saying that drug-free meditation is bunk mean that there's no value to the practice of meditating? How much value do you think sitting around focusing on the mind can possibly have? Well, what's your objective? What's the purpose of meditating? What's the promise? What are the marketing promises? Meditate so that X. So that what? So that you're enlightened, so that you're mellowed, so that you get this certain brand, certain flavor of experience? What is the promise that's being made, and how's the track record on on meeting that promise? How's the track record on meeting that promise of the goal, the supposed objectives for the supposed objectives for? Does saying that drug-free meditation is bunk mean that there's no value to the practice of meditating? The whole discussion of drug policy reform, the whole conceptualization of historical Jesus and our becoming accustomed to never understanding the mystery religions, that's all one giant screen that God has put in our way, a giant systemic screen of distraction designed to keep us in a distracted, inefficient, ineffective approach, going about, as Wilbur wrote sometimes in his early books, going about spirituality in all the ways that are guaranteed to put it off. So that this non-drug meditation school is actually serving, in effect, systemically, it's serving in practice as a way of holding off and avoiding enlightenment. God, why does God want to, or Satan, or God wants to hide from himself? So then drug-free meditation is used basically as a way for God to hide from himself. Now, if you want to, so you must say, well, why? If drugs are effective for what I expect out of spirituality, then, well, what do I expect? What do you expect out of spirituality? I think there's a lot of goal issues here. And what should we expect spirituality to give? Now, I'm saying that we should expect spirituality to give it those kinds of things that are experienced in the intense mystic altered state. That's what we should. I'm saying that, according to my judgment, that's what we should be expecting out of religion, and that's the standard we should be using to judge it by. By what standards do we judge religion? Do we judge religion by the standards of mundane moral conduct? Do we judge religion by its ability to, its effectiveness, its degree of effectiveness in mental transformation? So those are issues with saying that drug-free meditation is bunk. It really is a matter of, well, why are you meditating? Are you meditating to try to have a mystic state experience? And if so, why aren't you using drugs, which are clearly incomparably more effective way of doing that? Really, we just have a litany of the usual excuses and perspectives that always get all the print airtime, so that we have a shallow consensus established. The advantage of disorganized thought is it frees up thought structures to shift into different thought structures. It frees up thought structures to go into different thought structures. How does the ego death theory relate to the shamanic ability to heal? The shamanic ability to heal, we think about that, the convention is to think about that in a magical way. When I see healing, there's a metaphor. The most solid connection you have between the issue of shaman's ability to heal and the ego death theory is the metaphor of healing as healing the false impression of separateness of the separate self, as in Blue Oyster Cult song, "Kill My Friends, Cure My Friends, Black Blade," where he says, the sword is making me kill my friends, but he pronounces it as cure my friends. To heal, to clean, to wash and to heal, the same terms in Aramaic or something like that. And to wash clean of the delusion. So once we enter the realm of metaphor here, metaphor is, and metaphoricity about healing. So we can then establish a common basis here. Using metaphor, the metaphors for shamanic healing and metaphors for healing as found in the promises and propaganda of the Roman Empire and the Christian response and rebuttals, the one-upmanship that went on there. So we have to understand so much of the healing claims are one-upmanship that is entangled with mystic state metaphor, where healing is used to actually be talking about not physical bodily healing, but psychological healing of the apparent difference between the self and the the larger system which actually generates that self, that separate self concept. Now, Wilbur is not wrong on what he says about these things, but he's not relevant. That's the problem, is that when it comes to the intense dissociative state, he lacks relevance. And the same with Eastern religion. Don't say ah. The same with Eastern religion is, as it is currently understood, is that it lacks relevance to what, one would have to ask. Lacks relevance to what? To what standard of religion? By what standards should we judge a religion? I propose new standards. The standards by which you should judge a religion are its capabilities to experience, to bring about the experience of separate self and mental regeneration. And not only, of course, the old ordinary state standards of that it upholds order, moral order in society. Of course, that's taken for granted. We don't need to stop and discuss that. But regarding spiritual mystic religion, by what standards should it be judged? Well, its effectiveness, its ability to deliver on its promises. If it promises much and delivers little, then something fishy is going on, and it's actually, spirituality is actually being used as a way to avoid itself. Spirituality becomes a way of avoiding spirituality then, if it's ineffective, if it's going about things in an ineffective and choosing the lesser effective of a path. It's to choose the lesser effective of a path would be to choose avoidance. And we have reasons to avoid mystic altered state experiencing. We have reasons to avoid mystic state, altered state experiencing. And it's no wonder that the mind is partly designed to hide from itself this way. So that spirituality is serving in practice as a way of avoiding spirituality and avoiding the mystic state. So you're faced with a choice between vagueness and impossible to meet demands on time and that kind of standard. You're faced with the choice between that standard versus a viable standard, a reasonable standard. Don't we all want enlightenment as soon as possible? This whole idea that we have to give in to years of transformation. See, that's the downside of the Eastern thing, the Eastern religion, is that it's portrayed as this long, difficult path that takes decades. A multi-decade difficult path, whereas Western religion is structured more as initiatory transformation of a short 7 sessions duration that's a lot more manageable and relatively a sudden instantaneous initiation, rather than this ongoing, drawn out and ever ongoing thing that where you never really reach any kind of milestone. Where you never really reach any kind of major milestone. Now, in the Eastern mythology, of course, there are... Eastern mythology is this huge, wide range of things. I mean, meditation, how can you talk? It's an overgeneralization to talk about meditation. We're really having debates over what constitutes meditation, like what does real shamanism amount to, and what is merely degenerate as... Who's to say, by what standards are you going to judge those? Which one was the origin? Which one is the legitimate approach? Which one is proven to be effective? And which one is a way of the universe actually effectively avoiding itself? Meditation can be harmful if it's used as a way to avoid spiritual mental transformation. And putting that off. Then meditation can be used for the purposes of secondary level religion, which is conduct of life religion, but if that's all it has to offer, then it's not really a religion if it only has to offer the conduct of life content, promises, and potential, and practical potential, proven practical potential that's testable, testably possible. Now, is meditation testable? Well, they roll out their gizmo measuring things, and some arguments are made, but it's not a cognitive phenomenology. So as far as here's a way to judge whether one whether certain whether religious claims are valid or whether certain definition of religious goals or conceptualization of religious goals are actually legitimate or not, is are they readily testable? Readily testable. Are they readily testable? In a rational modern approach, we won't accept something unless it's readily testable. Now, defining meditation as requiring, well, they say, yes, it's readily testable. You can measure the brain waves. Well, that's, so I'm saying that a more legitimate standard for judging claims of what spirituality goals are, instead of looking to the brain measuring machines, a superior criterion of judgment is in terms of cognitive psychology. That's what the ego death, that's the strength of the ego death theory, is that it's measurable and immediately testable and accessible in terms of cognitive psychology, immediately, and cognitive phenomena, and cognitive science, cognitive content, and cognitive dynamics about personal control agency. It's got claims and dynamics that are immediately testable, and you can say that things that you can experience and go, yes, that is a religious experience. I had that experience. It was the ultimate experience. I feared. I had to put my trust in the ground of being, and I found that I was not willing to trust the ground of being to hold my control of my near future thoughts in its hands, because why should I trust this mysterious ground of being thing? It's just a philosophical concept anyway. Why should I put my trust in something so important as my own near future thoughts? Why should I trust those over to and grant them over to the ground of being? How can the ground of being be trusted with my thoughts? Because we're not talking about someone's thoughts in the general here. We're talking about my own thoughts that's very dear to me and affects what I'm going to do in the next 5 minutes. And can the ground of being be trusted with that? You'll sit there and say, well, the ground of being is nice because it's non-dualistic and that's all nice and peace and light and everything. And you sit there in your ordinary state of consciousness and can say all those things. But when it comes down to it, really, when things really get tight, are you willing to put your trust in the ground of being? And then there we enter into metaphors in the Christian and Western religious systems in general. But it really transcends any Western or Eastern or shamanistic division of trust in the... So now feedback loops is a way that the system can bootstrap on itself. And cybernetics certainly is the right approach. So we've got cognitive psychology, testable cognitive psychology contents, and we've got cybernetics and control loops, and we've got Hofstadter in there, and the way that systems feed back. Okay, today's status quo worldview includes a certain bunk view notion of what New Testament Christianity is all about, and that's the whole status quo mentality and theories of the alien psychology theory of the primitive religion and all these mistakes in all these different 20 different fields are all sort of conspired to be to generate. They stay entrenched because of certain feedback loops. Systemic feedback loops is what keeps all of these. We become accustomed to not understanding. All the academics become accustomed to saying, we don't understand really mystery religions, and it's the status quo kind of feedback system. So we've got feedback loops to look at there in the status quo. The status quo is entrenched by utilizing feedback loops, including becoming accustomed to not understanding. You say, well, we don't understand. That's just us, you know, we're just us moderns. We can't understand all that alien psychology of the ancient primitives. So that's an example of how feedback loops are crucial towards a status quo delusion world model and a matrix kind of a setup. Now, this world does have a kind of a matrix false reality thing, like the way that the routine war actions are covered in the media is an unreality, like a Philip K. Dick kind of sort of unreality. And the status quo mindset and world reality tunnel uses feedback loops to keep itself entrenched. Those feedback loops include standards of religion, standards of how we think about what the goal of meditation is, and how we assume that the standards are our whole picture of that we've gotten used to a whole way of thinking about the what constitutes the standards, and those get reported on in the media. Those get reported on in the routinized way. We get accustomed to talking about them in a certain way and highlighting certain aspects and de-emphasizing other aspects. Just as when a Christian book comes out on Christianity as shamanism, you see the drug aspect completely censored out, written out of it, and that kind of writing is encouraged, systemically encouraged. So the system is, the status quo system is actually encouraging us to keep on in the same mistakes, to keep on in the same half-baked approaches. It's designed to hold us from, away from the transcendent transformation and breakthrough transformation. We should be demanding a breakthrough transformation immediately. And so the status quo in religion is actually designed to prevent and hold off such a breakthrough transformation, which is why so often always in the history of religion, in Western religion, you have these revelation, end of time, total revolutionary transformations, because the people are looking for a breakthrough transformation, just as Caesar's claims to radically transform the world all at once, which was really a tangible, concrete thing then, and it's tangible and concrete now for us too. But we need to do such a revolution within fields of religion even. How is it that even the wonderful field of Buddhism has become corrupt and misled and has now become to serve as something designed to prevent its own, prevent enlightenment more than anything? You're going about enlightenment in ways that are guaranteed to avoid enlightenment. The current conception of meditation is precisely that which is most effective at holding at bay the mental cognitive transformation. This whole set of judgments and standards and criteria of judging is part of the whole scheme that's actually serving to hold us, hold religion at bay. Now, once you do have mental transformation and acknowledge the superior efficacy of the psychoactives, then certainly meditation is fine and harmless, because then it's not being used as a way of avoiding religion. It's the put-downs of, it's when the meditation advocates put down and disparage and minimize. See, that's the status quo political voice, political interest speaking there. To downplay, to try to spin and downplay the rightful role of the entheogens in their effectiveness and their original source. Certainly the original source of meditation, the whole idea of meditating, was certainly the visionary plants. No doubt about that. People didn't accidentally say, gee, by accident I'm going to sit and meditate for 30 years. No, but by accident they did take the mushroom, which caused them to enter a more reflective state. Now, which scenario sounds more plausible? One of them makes sense, one of them doesn't. You be the judge. What makes more sense? Jesus came along and had a new system of moral judgment and invented this new religion and sacrificed himself for vicarious sacrifice, waving your arms around a lot here, so that we would be saved, and what, and those strange primitive alien psychology, I can't really follow what they're saying, and this Jesus guy comes along and he's all religious and then somehow gets reborn and what, and all this stuff and hand waving. Do you buy into that status quo view, the historical Jesus, and the associated confusion and the sense of being accustomed to not understanding, forever not understanding mystery religions, forever saying that we can't understand them because of alien psychology? So how could we possibly, we advanced civilized moderns, understand primitive psychology, primitive alien psychology? Certainly had nothing to do with drugs, right?